Into the final moments, Alex Payne trying to keep this side going forward. Haskell takes it on now with just relentless chat, largely about himself. And there's Tindall to add the finishing touch of glamour and World Cup winning stories and a slightly sideways nose. That is how you podcast. A dominant display by the good, the bad and the rugby.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I said to you, what is the biggest party in rugby? If you could show me anything other than the Hong Kong Sevens, I think the three of us would buy a ticket. Welcome to this week's Good, the Bad and the Rugby in partnership with our very good friends at Continental Tires from Hong Kong, where this place is going off. Hask and Tins are alongside. And on this week's show, we're getting into the state of the game of sevens. There's a lot of fun to be had, but there's improvement too. Hask has been here for 3 or 4 days. How good has this been?
What an unbelievable place. What a vibe. Every stadium needs a south stand. If you haven't got a south stand, what are you even doing playing sport in front of one?
What have we learned in the 12 hours that we've been here?
Pace yourself, because it could go anywhere, and you've always got to be prepared. Like the Boy Scouts say, always be prepared.
Always be prepared. The aim of this show is to get seven guests talking about the state of sevens, but it's the Hong Kong Sevens. Anything goes. Hold on tight and enjoy the show. Well, it's the morning after the night before, and I think it's fair to say, what a night it was. One or two of us have been well and truly Hong Konged, HKKO, for one in particular.
HKO,
exactly. And I think probably from one of the worst ever Viking claps and one of the best ever 12-hour sessions any of us have ever had in a stadium.
I don't quite understand how someone can be a DJ and be so uncoordinated.
It wasn't good.
I didn't understand.
He just claps like he's a three-year-old.
I didn't know we were clapping. No one told me. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
And then I thought you put your hands up. Yeah. And then there was clapping. You went, no. And I was like, what are you doing? Yeah. And then I looked at the video and I am behind.
Are you talking? Because there isn't much of a voice left. We'll just subtitle some intelligence onto the bottom of the screen. We are going to take about an hour just to have a little look at the state of play in sevens. Where is it now? Where is it going? How good was it in its absolute pomp? And how good could it potentially be as well? And we've got an array of guests who are going to join us to come and give their view, all wrapped around the greatest party, the greatest sevens event that there is, which is obviously here in Hong Kong. And it's a very warm welcome, firstly, to the shirt, and secondly, to the man inside it, the great Rob Vickerman, who is not only one of the greats of English sevens rugby, but also now part of World Rugby. Are you allowed to wear that as a World Rugby employee?
So here's one for you. First and foremost, this is sevens merch.
Is it really?
This is available to buy, all good outlets.
Good.
And is a representation of how the change is
coming. You have a 10% commercial interest, isn't it?
Sadly not, actually. But the bosses will be happy.
Can they got double XL, triple XL?
No, I just stick to small.
Yeah, it tends to be a bit tight. As small as possible is generally wrong.
Yeah, it's not tight, it's not right. That's the way it goes.
Good.
But no, wonderful to be here, isn't it? I've never felt so underdressed in a Hawaiian shirt before.
It's quite extraordinary, weird, isn't it? But also, that tends to sum up just how much fun, how much sort of, how Sevens approaches the game. And I think all of us would agree that we need to see more of that. Can we just start? What is your official job title at World Rugby?
My official job title, Alex, is Teams Marketing and Commercial Operations, which is essentially a way of trying to get opportunities for players, unions and teams in a way that perhaps World Rugby haven't done before. So how can we use the back room of World Rugby to support the teams and unions to grow, to be more commercial and more sustainable? That's the pitch.
Right.
That's the messaging. Because as you can see, this is an absolutely wonderful product when it's done right.
And what people will see as the show develops is the south stand in particular behind us begin to fill, and there'll be a lot of noise from there later on today. Lots of corporate activity as well. It's a very, very good day out. But what I want to start with you is, as someone who had 10 years on the circuit, if not longer, where is Sevens right now and where is it going relative to what you knew as a player?
Yeah, it's a great question. And actually, I wind it back a little bit because in 2009, it was officially introduced as an Olympic sport. I was still playing for England then, and that changed the conversation for what sevens could be. The caveat for them was, as it progressed, it hit a 2016 in Rio where the world saw sevens. They saw the Fiji story, admirably led by Ben Ryan, which was amazing. But it was a hit out. We didn't know what it was going to be like. 4 years further on from that, it was then the pandemic in Tokyo. I was lucky enough to be there commentating in an empty stadium. The sevens still stacked up, but the experience, the event, it wasn't there. However, now where we're going, with a bit of a change up at World Rugby, now taking in ownership of events, apart from three of their incumbents that are still being ran, as with this one, we're going to a market that gets rugby, that loves rugby. the French are going to adopt it. It's going to be the Antoine Dupont show preceding it, rightly so, because he's the poster boy of the game. And it's going to be supersonic. That's going to be the true realization for where Sevens can go in a wonderful occasion in Paris. The end of July, 6 days or 7 days, because they're breaking it up for the opening ceremony. The first medal that will be produced, the Olympic Games, will be a rugby sevens medal. It's going to be sold out at the Stade de France. That is pretty exciting.
Unbelievable. And I wonder if Antoine will get the medal this time that obviously he didn't get at the Rugby World Cup at the tail end of last year. The vision for sevens then, are you seeing it as a sport in which players can go between the two, like a Dupont and a Michael Hooper, or are you seeing a separate entity which grows its own stars? It's a slightly different sort of tournament calendar formula, etc. What is going to be the relationship between 15s and 7s?
I'm glad he's asking the questions, not used to it. That was a fantastic, wonderfully well-put question.
Thank you.
And it's a really relevant one because, again, back in 2009 when Olympics was announced, unions were like, OK, what do we do? We need to create programmes and pathways to ring-fence our talent to load so we can grow that Olympic pathway. So it became full-time. Many teams you're now seeing here are full-time 7s players. That was a dial change, but it also meant that the players who were flip-flopping between 15s and 7s had a bit of a decision to make. And at the time, if you're 18, 19, 20, you had the ability to travel the world to hit then 10 iconic cities, now 8, with Commonwealth Games, Olympic pathways, and a wonderful experience in life. Do you want to do that, or do you want to go down a 15s route, which we'll all contest is quite more attritional, it's pretty full on, and it's different, it's a different option and pathway. So that's why it changed a little bit in terms of the grand plan for where it could go. It's balancing the both, because as you can see, when you get an event right, when you market it properly, there is nothing like this in rugby. It's remarkable.
My worry about it, though, is you need that crossover. The biggest thing that's happened to sevens is Antoine Dupont going and playing sevens.
Yeah.
Because he's huge in the 15. So you need to have that crossover. Even going back to when Ollie Phillips played, Dan Norton played. You know, is GB the right thing to have? Or should we have an England, Wales, Scotland? Should we have that? I used to love watching those guys play as England.
Yeah.
Obviously, Vesta, that we both were good mates with Ollie Phillips and everything else, but it's having that balance. Why was it so good back in the pomp when Cullen played, when Lomu played?
Yeah.
But, you know, you need the crossover of players. My worry is if it suddenly turns into completely, solely sevens, has it got the market? But obviously, the day out is fantastic. Yeah. Everyone knows it.
Yeah.
And why it's unique is, the problem is with rugby, if you come into an international, work in the corporate space that I work, people come in 3 hours, they just go absolutely nuts and they leave. Whereas here, there's a nice flow about it. You know, obviously, we spent all day yesterday walking around, seeing the sponsors, moving around, and there's a whole day where you can actually get work. If you are to do it as a corporate gig, you can get work done here because you've got the whole day here. You don't have to go mental. Whereas at Twickenham now, I reckon 50% of the people who go won't remember the game, you know what I mean? Whereas here's a bit differently. Obviously, South Stand may be unique in its own right, but that's my worry is I think you need that crossover to not just have sevens fans, you need to bring the whole rugby fraternity in. They all know what you'll get as a day out, but the product always has to
Can deliver. I just come in on that? Because that's a really relevant point. We obviously want Dupont to be playing because he's the marquee name and he's wonderful at sevens. Sonny Bill Williams, Rio did the same. Brian Abana had a crack, couldn't make it. These are freakish athletes. So we're not just going to cherry pick the best rugby players. But what I'll do is flip it and say, how do we get to the point where they want to compete in Olympic Games? And that's probably a little bit of a financial thing as well. Like the IPL works because they're the best cricket players on the planet.
Yes.
As a whole, that go and entertain. They're also paid astonishingly well. Live, similar concept. You're getting these conversations because it's a financial transaction. So we need to grow that, which is why it needs to be a commercial product and grown as a commercial product.
Which is exactly the question I was going to ask, is that if you were trying to find three ingredients to get sevens to explode, money has to be in there. What other two would you put in?
With three, we try and use sevens to talk about is about informing the casual viewer. How do you get them to think, oh, actually, rugby's a pretty cool sport. It's simplistic in the fact that it's seven rather than 15.
Yeah.
The laws are slightly easier to understand. I won't say they're easy to understand, but easier. There's the engagement, which you see here. Don't just make it rugby. You go to attend the sevens. You don't go to sevens rugby to watch just the teams play. So it's immersive. It's food, beverage, it's music. It's getting really good DJs to play and Hask.
We found any of those.
Yeah. And he can help, you know. And that's it. You need to make the whole thing sing. So It's immersive, it's got to be informative, it's got to be engaging, but ultimately it needs to be financial. And that's why the change has happened.
Can I ask you a question about being here? It's absolutely sensational, but as a viewer on television, it's a big ask. It's 2, if not 3 days. The peaks and troughs are very, very different to 80 minutes of Six Nations rugby, where you're in, you get right into the centre of it, and then you're out at the back of it. How big a challenge is it to make the product box office for television?
Yeah, it's a very good point. I think, I don't know what the easy answer is to that, because, you know, when you're having a prolonged amount of play, which is very different, as you said, I think obviously the fact that the game is as limited players in the field, there is a lot of entertainment around that. You know, the footwork, the carries, the big moments. It can turn. You know, we were watching Spain versus South Africa, and there was, you know, the Spanish ladies were up 19 points, almost threw it away. And you don't really get that in rugby happening within 3 minutes.
I think Sevens has always gone on a little bit of a roller coaster. There's a part where you'll always remember the way you used to love watching it. The skill sets, I feel generally in rugby, the players don't ever let the side down. Like, whether it be international rugby in 15s or whether it's 7s, the skill sets and everything else are there. It's the commercialisation of how we actually maximise what we do and how the players benefit off the back of that. And that's the biggest question for someone like Rob. How do you do that consistently that you then benefit the game? I quite like the idea that 15s guys should switch to 7s, 7s should switch to 15s. And, you know, so many other sports do it, where, you know, the All Blacks for so long would have a sabbatical and they go away and do something else. And Sonny Bill has done more sports than anyone else. And we've got to encourage that, because that actually brings more fans to the table.
I was going to just say, I think one of the things that I think was holding Sevens back a little bit was obviously back in the day, we talked about it. I think coaches saw a lot of value in it.
Yes.
I think they saw a real value in going away. You know, adapting your core skills, because your core skills are exposed in rugby like no other in sevens. And I think a lot of players can hide in 15s. So if you can't pass off both hands in 15s, you can hide. You know, if your one-on-one tackle isn't great, you can hide in 15s. You can get away with it. In sevens, you can't. And it used to be a perfect way to go and develop. And I thought coaches used to see it as a serious way of developing players. Then obviously when the Olympic stuff came in, they became two separate sports. And suddenly you had these kind of real athlete players, which were a sport in itself. I think we need to go back a bit more to where coaches see the real value in it. We do get the players coming backwards and forwards. We get a bit more exposure. Obviously, this is a much harder game to play now because the sports science behind it. I mean, I remember the fitness levels and requirements are totally different than when I did it. And I just think if coaches saw it more seriously, we should see young players. Instead of going young players, you know, sitting in academies all day long, I'd put them into sevens. I'd see England coaches should look at this as an opportunity to test people out.
Can I ask you three sort of punchy bullet point ones to finish with? Team GB or England, Scotland, Wales? How important is it to have a strong presence in the UK and Ireland for the success of a sevens entity, given the commercial pull, the numbers, the eyeballs, etc.?
Liken it to a bit of hockey. Team GB has a real value, both commercially and what you're witnessing here. This is GB playing, by the way. You can hear the noise
in the
background.
Team GB have just beaten Canada. Oh, they're having this. They've got a minute to go.
We're in a place where, you know, the English representation used to be strong. GB equally is accepted here. It's also a format that went from 16 to 12 teams. The GB model fitted with that as well. There's a lot of opinion on it, rightly so. You're taking three very patriotic nations that are merging it. But fundamentally, it can work and will work. We just all need to understand how this commercial backing can fly through.
Second question is, and you made a very good point, which is, and I love it, which is Sevens actually is a product that is focusing on the in-fan experience first of all, which is what makes this place so extraordinary, rather than the eyeballs on television. And that is probably one of its big challenges. What is the best potential television Sevens product? Because I was thinking of the Prem Sevens, which was four teams every Friday night. The winner went through to a final, and it was 3 hours. It was a great Friday night out. That seems to be a more sort of digestible entity to get into as a viewer on television than the 3 days that you and I used to do in a Sky studio eating sandwiches until we popped.
Yeah, is that just because your liver couldn't take it?
Yeah, I mean, they were brutal, brutal, grueling.
It was brutal. Speaking about brutal, the Prem Sevens, it was a great format. It was back-to-back games. We had a three-minute break in between games here. You would not be able to do that. So from a player welfare point of view, that has to be taken into account as well. Yeah. But I understand the question, and I think that's still a pertinent question. At the moment, the biggest broadcasting draw is to have the golden hour, the show, the big event. Slightly summative, because it can still be an immersive experience, but then you hit the big games. The quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals here are electric. It's amazing. Yeah. That's probably the best broadcasted bit, but it's still to be solved, I'd say.
Last question.
Yes.
And the show sort of, the shirt answers it almost in itself. How excited are you about where Sevens will be? And you put the time frame on it, 12 months, 24 months, 36 months. Where is this sport going to get back to if what you're talking about comes through?
So I'm lucky enough to be going to work on the Olympics in Paris, first 7 days of the tournament, before the opening ceremony. For me, that will be the most seismic moment for Sevens sport, because it's going to show this concept, this product, to the wider world. 2.3 billion people watch the Olympics. This is great, but it's not the same level, it's not the same stage. 3 weeks, 4 weeks after that, when my come down's finally leveling off, that's where I think I'll be really reflective on what's just happened. That's probably going to be 12 months, maybe even 2 years in the building process. We're saying 3 years as a Sevens entity to really grow this product and concept. We're at end of year one coming up to it with some massive moments. So for me, it's not a short-term win. It's a longer-term focus. But as you can see, there's so much about this wonderful sport that gets me excited. So much.
Good man.
Including the shirt.
Keep fighting the good fight. It's Always. Really good to hear of some positivity. We love positivity on this show. Rob, we'll release you back.
What? Yorkshire positivity. It's a rare thing, isn't it?
Hey, for Yorkshireman to be positive is very rare.
We really must all be drinking from
Cheers,
the right
Cheers, guys. Enjoy.
Well done. Thank you. Thank you very much. Rob, we're going to pop you out. And as we say goodbye to the great Rob Vickerman, we're going to bring in, I hope you won't mind saying this, the even greater DJ Forbes, who is one of the all-time greats of this sport, and is also, I mean, we've gone from the incredible shirt to the incredible sunglasses. I mean, it is all absolute show here in Hong Kong.
He's on, still on the front cover, one of the biggest names
that this sport has ever had. First things first, how are you after 3-4 days in Hong Kong? We've got what's left of James Haskell. Tins only had 12 hours to fill himself. You look well, you look healthy, and you're wearing a big old smile. How have you found it?
Not my first radio, so I've been walking in the shadow of James lately, so I think he's doing it for all of us, so I can't complain. I mean, I'm always grateful to be brought back. I think I'm around about maybe 15 or 16 years in Hong Kong, 11 as a player, and then the last sort of 4 or 5 years as an ambassador. So, great opportunity. So I'm pretty stoked to be here for particularly the last one.
Good. You did almost 90 tournaments, which is a lot of work to get through. Commonwealth gold medalist, obviously captain of the All Black Sevens as well. And we talk about one of the biggest names in this sport. But when you touched on it already, but what is it about Hong Kong that when it goes into the calendar, you ring it in red and you say, it's going to be a good week?
Yeah, well, I think for a lot of us, when we were playing, I mean, Hong Kong was like the World Cup of the circuit. The aura that the stadium creates, I mean, running out of that tunnel, you know, it's, you know, second to none. So definitely was one of those spots. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased. I'm going to say Wellington was, you know, next in line. But to make a Hong Kong tournament and to even potentially win one definitely goes in the, you know, in the memories quite high up the pecking order.
What do you make of, we've been talking with Rob about the sort of trajectory of the overall game. What do you make of the journey that Sevens has been on over the last, I mean, let's call it 5 years?
Oh, I think it's moved leaps and bounds, not just in the men's game, you know, across the board, both men's and women's. Some of the skill and talent on show from the women's games is sort of, you know, trailblazed for a lot of young, you know, boys and girls, you know, wanting to play Sevens. But I think for the men's, I mean, these guys are units now, like, you know, 6'4+, 100Ks, and they can move. But then you see, you know, 15 superstars like Hooper coming back into the fold, and there's still an element of the contact and the defense that, you know, us genuine forwards still need, you know, our little place here on this Sevens field. So, you know, it's a good mix now, and it's an Olympic sport. So definitely, you know, a spectacle for everyone to watch.
We were just saying beforehand, do you feel that they still need to be connected, Sevens and 15s? You know, you talk about Hooper, talk about Dupont, you talk about, you know, we were just talking about the good old days of Cullen, Lomu. You know, do you feel it has to have the connection between both sports, or could it roll in itself as just elite Sevens and elite 15s and they don't touch each other? Or?
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of both. I mean, in some countries, you'll be able to get away with that. And in other countries, they're going to put all their eggs in one basket and invest totally in an Olympic sport. I think there's still opportunity for it as a pathway. Some of the skills you learn on a Sevens field, you know, if you're a forward or a 15s player in general, it's going to set you up for a pretty good place when you go back to your 15s campaign. Ultimately, you know, the fitness space you need to run around on a Sevens field is, you know, another level. But like I say, you know, I did, I think, maybe 6 years of both Sevens campaigns straight into 15s campaigns. And besides, I guess, the size difference and a little bit of weight you sort of need to put on and cut off, you know, definitely a lot of value playing both.
Which is a really interesting question. I want to get into that a little bit more. The physical demands of flicking between the two, for someone like Dupont, what will he have had to have physically done going from Toulouse in France into the French Sevens? Is it just endless cardio? Have you got to lose weight? What have you got to do physically to be able to compete in this?
Probably not so much losing weight and whatnot, as long as you can, you know, do what's required
shift in terms it.
Of the case. Yeah, and so I know, depending on the type of program that they run, it'll be more just trying to get used to the amount of Ks you'll do in a working week. And 15 is a lot different. You're sort of building and then tapering for a Saturday, whereas here, obviously they'll want to see that, you know, he can bank the Ks and ensure that he can go the distance. And then obviously, you know, trying to make sure that come tournament time, especially like somebody like Hong Kong, obviously he's not here, but a three-day tournament, you can't do 80 minutes and turn off. You got to get up and down. So there's a mental aspect to you and everything like that.
I was going to say, I always remember we used to do this England fitness test, this down and up test. And it was brutal as it was. But if you wanted to be a seven, you had to do it twice. You had to do it back to back. And it's just carnage. I mean, the level, like Dan Norton, we spoke to Dan Norton last night, his repeatability, the ability to be able to just sprint, like for him, sprint 100 and go again. And that was all he used to do. It was like repeat hundreds, 15, 20, which is horrendous.
I'm tired even just thinking about it, like trying it.
You obviously came out of the Gordon Titchin School of kind of sevens coaching, which was at the time probably the hardest program, wasn't it? I mean, you guys used to win everything because what I believed of the fitness and the demands on you were like no other. Was that right? I mean, was it as crazy as people say it was?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably paying the price, you know, now with my knees and everything else.
I'll see 24, it's been a tough paper round.
Yeah, so, and I mean, yeah, there's definitely attributes that I have now because of what he sort of put us through. In terms of, baseline fitness and things like that, the expectation was another level. And yeah, we did. We beat teams and we hung in games because we were simply fitter than a lot of teams. And I guess that was, you know, we're touching on that sort of transition as the game morphed into a lot more skill and strategy and everything else. There was still an element of, trying to be the fittest team, but also needing all the skill sets to, I guess, just navigate and, you know, evolve with what's sort of being played out there now that we see.
Is there anything that sticks in your mind in terms of a session that you remember being the worst out of all of them? Because I don't think people at home necessarily, when we talk about the fitness test, all this kind of stuff, the level of running and the stuff you have to do is mind-blowing. Is there anything that really sticks in your mind about what you did?
I mean, a stock standard session back when he was running, we weren't centralised, so we'd drive in from our wherever. So the Auckland boys would sit 3 hours in a van, cooped up in a van, we'll get out, we'll sort of do the highs and welcomes and, you know, get allocated your hotel room. And within about an hour and a half, we'll go straight to the hall to do the beep test. And in Titch's eyes, sort of like anything 14 plus was expected in a beep test. You do the beep test and you think, oh, yeah, it's good, you know, I've done my bit. And you would have a recovery, which was lunch, and then we'd be back into a phosphate test, which is about the repeated speed. So that's the 10, 40-meter sprints. And I guess there's those old days when, I guess some of us Island boys would think we'll try and cheat the system and do one or two really fast ones and then cruise and then do a couple at the end. But, you know, Titch obviously came to us pretty quickly around the stats saying, I want to see you guys as fast as you can from the start. And trying to
you
minimize
should be dropping
it
off.
Yeah,
should,
exactly.
I used to love that about fitness tests. The guy who would always be best at the last one. Yeah. Suddenly he comes from nowhere. He's been back all the way. Then suddenly, are you fine now? Yeah. No, go hard. You should always be dropping off.
I mean, Gordon Titchin's reputation is extraordinary for those of us who have followed the sport, but only know him as the legend. As someone who's worked under him, what are your levels of respect, affection, sort of gratitude for what he put in place in New Zealand?
I mean, I still sort of, you know, run around in a different sense now and people sort of see me as, you know, still very fit. And that's purely because of what I did.
Are you boxing now? Are you still doing the boxing?
Oh, that was a one-off. Yeah, I do a bit of CrossFit now. But I mean, I guess people see me running around. And the only reason I'm still running around is basically I've got this thing ingrained in me now that, you know, when you're sort of pushing yourself, you're not really half-assing or anything like that. You really want to go to the red and stay in the red as long as you can. And then I only kind of get my fulfillment when I've sort of gone to that sort of barrier, which is probably detrimental because I'm 42 now and sort of feeling all the effects, but you know, I can't just go out for a nice leisurely bike ride or a walk around the mountains and stuff. I need to be operating in the rear to get that sort of satisfaction that I've been so used to.
And you thank him for that?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Can I thank him? Or, you know, I'm grateful.
Because you're obviously getting into coaching yourself as well. When you coach yourself, is he someone that you would follow, or you know, is there anyone else really particularly has helped you shape the way you're going to coach sevens?
I think there'll be certain elements if I'm, you know, going to be sort of coaching sevens, you know, definitely, you know, some of the methods, there's still a place for just old school fitness, you know. Yeah. And I think there is that sort of, a lot of the generation has sort of gone to the other side of the line. And I think for me personally, I would still be expecting a certain standard. But then there's obviously, I was under Tana Umanga at one stage, Eric Rush, you know, when I was playing sevens, even Joe Smith when I was playing in development. So I've had some great coaches that I'll hopefully use to apply my own philosophies.
Amazing. Can I ask you a question around superstars in the game? And in some way, I mean, it's lovely to have you on the show. In some ways, having you on the match programme is testament to all that you've achieved. But as the sport looks to break into new audiences, etc., who is the biggest star in sevens right now? And in some ways, the pause might answer the question.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. The amount of talent, you know, hand on heart, it's unbelievable. You know, and yeah, I guess if you sort of look back to when we were running around, there were a couple rock stars that were, you know, immediately identified and people sort of knew, oh, yeah, Mr. Sevens, or and all this kind of jazz. Whereas right now, I think, and it's not, you know, taking anything away from what you see out there, but just the amount of athletes, you know, unbelievable talent running across.
Do you think the sport needs its Rush and its Serevi and its DJ Forbes? Does it need stars who are totally identifiable within sevens relative to an Antoine Dupont coming over and making noise as the biggest star in 15 moving across?
Yeah, well, I think naturally there's, you know, a lot of, you know, seven stars that, you know, kids will look up to. And I think that does help grow the game and it does give all these sort of young boys and girls something to sort of aspire to. So that plays a massive part. But I think the game in itself is probably, you know, what everyone loves to see and they want to, you know, get amongst the action and give it a go.
I was just thinking back to one of the sevens. You remember William Ryder for Fiji, Sir Vardell Tate for the England guys.
I still, whatever sport you need, instantly recognisable names.
And that comes down to the marketing of it. What is the answer to how you build them?
I didn't really ever play sevens. I sort of missed that boat, passed in. You get hooked into those players. You know, there was always the stories around Carlin Isle. How fast was he? Then you go back to when I grew up, you know, watching Lomu, watching Cullen. You need those instantly recognisable, because they, like we always talk about in 15s, you need people who carry the sport. And at the moment, we have the same problems in 15s. We've got Dupont. Well, you've got quite a lot of French guys, but you don't have anymore. You don't have Richie McCaw. You don't have Dan Carter. But you need those names. Now, how do we do a better job of elevating those? Yeah. Because people pick up on that. Kids pick up on that.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to sell.
Can I ask you about the Olympics? Expectations for Paris? Who are the favourites? What are you most excited? I mean, will sevens reach a new level in Paris?
I think it'll definitely reach a new level. There may be some surprises. You know, I guess when you look at the series leading into an Olympics, the teams that are consistently good are the ones that, you know, going to have a lot of expectation on their shoulders. So even a team like Ireland, for example, you know, consistently be good this whole season. There'll be a lot of expectation on them. France at home. Obviously, the Kiwis haven't done too well, but in terms of, I guess, you know, where you want to be, you want to peak at the right time. So there's teams that have done extremely well this series so far. We haven't, but, you know, today, the last couple of days, the team's sort of looking on the up again, Australia.
Yeah.
So, I think, you know, there will be some surprises, but it's going to be an awesome spectacle. And, you know, hopefully, I'm biased. I'm hoping that the boys peak at the right time.
Yeah. And I think everybody who is watching this and perhaps doesn't watch a lot of sevens will find themselves watching the Olympics. And that is what sevens can do and the way that it can hook you in. The last question I wanted to ask you about, we talk about defining images here. And England fans will remember winning, I think, 2004, they won it here. But a lot of people remember your Hacker in the Rain in 2011. Is that blown up in a sort of 20-foot poster at home above the bed? Is that one of the sort of great defining... Photoshop required. But is that, I mean, was that victory for you? I mean, you won it three times here, but are those the days that you remember now from a glorious career?
They went viral, you know, so there was probably not so much, you know, it was us sort of doing our job, and it was always awesome to do a hacker. You know that you've succeeded and you've, you know, got the job done. But I guess, yeah, for that kind of iconic moment, definitely holds a, you know, special place in my heart. I know there is some rooms and some corporate areas that I've gone into, and there has been murals on the wall and whatnot.
If you were single, it'd definitely be your Tinder profile, wouldn't it? It'll be on every last.
Your dance floor move. Yeah, amazing.
Nah, but definitely grateful for those memories. And I mean, you know, and those are just one of many. But and I always say that the whole story, you know, there was a lot more that went into that, and there was a little bit of a downer where I was stuck in a cubicle and, you know, trying to do a drug test that same evening.
Oh, wow.
So when the team was back celebrating, you know, there was gridlock here because of black rain in Hong Kong. So I couldn't get out of the stadium. So it took me a little while to celebrate that victory, but got there in the end.
Good on you. Been really nice to have you in. Thank you so much for coming to have a chat. Just enjoy the rest of the weekend. DJ, you're a top man.
Thanks, man. us.
And we'll look forward to catching up along the way. Good on you. Thank you very much indeed. So from DJ Forbes, one of the all-time stars of the Sevens game, to David Campese, one of the all-time stars of our game in general, full stop. You. Certainly one of the most recognisable names from...
I don't think you were born when I played you in 82.
No, I was. No, I mean, like, scary, I cried in 91.
Oh, did you?
I did laugh in 89, but I did cry in 91.
I know.
So, well, it was because of 89, I played well in 91. So,
is that right?
Yeah. I know he's a legend because it's the first thing he tells you when you meet him.
I think we've seen each other three or four times. I think 84 has come up a couple of times on that as well. And actually, funny enough, because I was going to come on to... Do you remember a video called Bill's Best Bits? Did you ever get a copy of that from the great Bill McLaren? Do you remember
Bill McLaren? I think I did, yes. Yeah.
So you are littered across that, I think, for the Barbars, for Australia, and I think in the Sevens as well, actually. How are you, first of all? How has Hong Kong treated you?
Yeah, it's interesting being back.
Because?
Because of COVID and all that. So I think I played here 12 times, which is great, and that I've been back and forth all the time. But look, it's just great because you get to see some of the old players. That's what Sevens is about, though. Yeah. You know, they get the opportunity to see people that they've known for years, and that's part of what the Sevens is all about.
One of the reasons I'm really pleased that we've got you on is we've spent a bit of time talking to Rob Vickerman from World Rugby and DJ about where Sevens is now. But one of the things I'd love to get into with you is how good was it when you played here? And it was obviously an amateur sport, etc. Yeah. You did 12 tournaments, but we're talking about Lomu and Cullen and Serevi and some of the absolute all-time greats of Sevens that you'd have gone up against.
Yeah,
tell us a little about your experiences here as a player.
Well, I presented the jerseys to the Australian team on Wednesday night. And I got up and I said, guys, my first tour was 83. We arrived on a Wednesday night. The guys went out for a few beers.
Right.
Thursday morning, we trained for an hour, had lunch, went shopping. Friday, trained for an hour, go shopping. Everyone came and got their suits and all that made here. Played Saturday, Sunday, win. Monday, shopping, go home. That was it.
Wow.
It was the only tournament we ever played. It was Sevens here. And the reason it was so good, because they're all test players.
Yeah.
You had Blanco, Jean-Baptiste Lafon, you had Jay Jeffries, who's going to be the president of World Rugby, Jonathan Davies, and everyone here knew who they were. But when we started, we used to sit with the supporters in the grandstand after the game with mud and everything. We sat down and the supporters are with us. You know, now it's more, if you watch, it's more about defence instead of flair, attack, guys trying different things like Serevi. I mean, playing Serevi, like, you had no idea what he was going to do. He had no idea either, but that's what the people wanted.
We obviously had the Lions playing here on their way to Australia in 2013 against the Barbars, which was, I mean, you played in that, didn't you?
I unfortunately remember that, yeah.
How was that?
76-0 or whatever we got beat,
yeah. That was a tough afternoon at the office. This pitch will get you.
It was a tough week, I'll be honest with you.
What are your expectations for next year and the Lions, given where Australia are right now?
Look, I think we'll do pretty well because we've got the same players who have been there for a couple of years now. So we don't have to go and look for players. But we just got to give the players the skills to play. We've got really good individual skills.
Yep.
But sometimes they forget, you don't beat the whole team. You beat one player, that's your job. Pass the ball and off you go. I've been cancelled in Australia.
Have you?
Right. I can't coach.
Hi.
I don't do articles.
I've been cancelled in the UK.
I do nothing.
Welcome to the Rejects pod.
Yeah.
During the World Cup last year, I did all my Planet Rugby podcasts all in Europe.
Right.
In South Africa and New Zealand, nothing in Australia.
Right.
The only time they ring me when Australia loses.
Oh, really?
Because they know I'm going to give them a headline.
Yeah.
But I can't do it. I can't coach. Can't do anything.
Why?
Because I tell them what the truth is.
Yeah. Right.
And the problem in Australia now, rugby supporters, we've got no say. This year's 40 years of the Rugby Grand Slam.
Yeah.
It's the last time we won. 1984. No one knows. No one knows what's happening.
Yeah.
Which is really sad. So we've lost our culture and our history.
Right.
We've gone through coaching. We've had Eddie. Now we've got another New Zealander. And I said, what about having an Australian coach who's understand the Australian style?
So who would you have gone? I mean, Joe Schmidt's a hell of a coach. I mean, there's obviously
but there's another New Zealand. We're not New Zealand.
No, sure.
We're Australians.
Yeah.
New Zealand will never get an Australian coach.
No.
No.
So who would you have picked?
Well, actually, believe it or not, I said to Phil Wall, I said, mate, give me the back line for 12 months.
Right.
Bring in Laurie Fisher, bring in a couple of other Aussies, and let's play Australian rugby.
There's so many late switches in the
Goose steps over the shoulder.
I tell you, at least we'll be able to counter-attack and attack.
Yeah.
The game is about defence. They spent all their time on defence. And if you watch last year's World Cup, our fullback, Callaway, is a good player. We've got really good individuals.
Yeah, very good individuals.
But the problem is we haven't got centres to give the ball to the wingers.
Yeah.
And when they get it, they want to be 10 guys.
Everyone sticks a winger at
centre
now.
So it's about trying to...
Centres was the hardest place on the planet. And so some people could do it, some people couldn't.
But the problem is in Australia, we got four football codes.
Yeah.
rugby league's dominating, Aussie Rules got all the money, and we're not winning. If you don't win in Australia, yeah. you're in big trouble. Yeah. And we won, when we played, we entertained.
Yep.
And that's why rugby became so passionate, because yeah. we were winning, we style. Now, we've lost. It's about defence. We don't want defence. You need the flair. You need the guy to say, mate, go out there and have a go.
Yeah.
It's not there anymore.
Right.
I feel that, like, Australia now have lost their identity or yep. what they are.
Well, they're trying to find
them. Remember, they've always been, you know, if I go through the history of me watching Australia, playing against Australia, they were always so studious and, for so long the Institute of Sport was the golden beacon. And now it's like you expect them to be able to put a plan together and execute. You know, even like 2015, Bernard Foley, how they scored those tries where they just have runners inside, outside him, and he just played. Whereas at the moment, you go into the World Cup in France last year, they just didn't have that. They were trying to be something else, whether Eddie was trying to make them, again, know that they're in a difficult situation, but instead of going embracing the young players that you had and go play the way that suits them, things that we've talked about, Borkers, for the last sort of couple of years, we've had all these great youngsters, and until the last three games of the Six Nations, we're going, well, we're not even playing any rugby.
Yeah.
And then, if you give them a bit of freedom and the responsibility to go and hold themselves accountable, you get better results out the back of it.
It's interesting, and I'd love to ask you this. So we put out onto our social media, any of our fans can send in a question. Oh, unsurprisingly, yeah. The one came into you. But it is related to Hong Kong. So this came in from Sammy Boy, and it's our Continental Tires question of the week. And it was for Campo. The best player that you played against in sevens, and why?
Let me see. We had Jean-Baptiste Lafond play.
Who was one of my favourites.
Unbelievable.
Great.
He's bonkers.
Yeah.
Really crazy guy.
Him and Laurent Cabane.
I love the French. Serge Blanco.
Yeah.
Jonathan Davies played, all those greats, because we played against them all the time.
Yeah.
But I must say, Sir Revy would be very close, because just watch him play, he'll stand there with the ball and he'll score the other end. That's what made people come to watch.
Yeah.
Even the Commonwealth Games. Obviously, Christian Carlin, Jonah Lomu started here in 94.
Yeah.
Christian Carlin gets a ball under the post, scores the other end. That's what you want.
We asked the question to DJ about how you build global superstars. What is your answer to that in a professional context?
Just be different.
What?
Just be different.
Be different.
Try different things. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Yeah.
You talk.
Would you have relished playing in the professional era now? I mean,
well,
you
I
had
played
your
until 98.
Right.
And we were.
You were 74 though at that time in 98.
Yeah, I was. Very old.
So the social media era. You'd have had a hell of a showreel on TikTok. I mean, you would have been right up there.
Yeah, TikTok. But I'm not interested because
for sure.
It's,
but my point is 89. If a player was to do that now, it would be very. I mean, that would be an uncomfortable 6-12 months with the social media judgment. And what is your advice to someone like that?
Look at
Sam Kane in the World Cup final.
Yeah, but if you look at 89, for example, okay. Three test matches, I touch the ball three times.
Right.
If I get the ball 20 times and make two mistakes, no one cares.
Yeah.
I get the ball three times and take two mistakes, the world knows.
Yeah.
So
and actually, for context, can you just explain what happened for those who might not have seen
it? So what happened in 89, we the first test we won, the second test all in brawl, the Lions realised we had to start punching and they beat us. The third test, Rob Andrew gets the ball, has a drop goal, he misses, I get the ball behind my try line. Because I wasn't confident, there was only Yane Evans, there was nobody. So I started to run, stopped, Greg Martin called, I passed, and Yane dives on the ball, scores a try. Anyway, so there was other incidents, there's still a long way to go. The British Lions won. So I was walking off, and some in the crowd said, oh, you lost another game for Australia. So I walked in the dressing room, sit down, not one player came near me for 10 minutes. Anyway, so Nick Farg-Jones and then Bob Dwyer came over. And so I said, don't worry about it. Walked off to the reception with Yane. I said, I'm going home. So I was sponsored by BMW back then. And my number plate was N011. Drove home, pulled over by the police for speeding. Go home. All of a sudden, the phone rings. St. Helens Rugby League offered me more money to play league. And I said, didn't you guys watch the game tonight? Anyway, so that was the night. The next day, we still had a game to go, which is the British Lions and the Anzac.
Yeah.
So the next day, I ring Bob Dwyer, the coach. I said, Bob, it's the mate. I'm not in a good mood. Don't pick me next week. Okay, won't pick him. I put the phone down. Then I realise I've just told the national coach what to do. So I ring him. I said, mate, if you want me, pick me. I did exactly the same pass the week after and it worked. But if it wasn't for that mistake, I wouldn't have played well in 91.
Yeah.
Because
when you won the World Cup,
go through like everything good. You've got to go ups and downs and you learn.
Yeah.
And that's
learning curves, isn't it?
That's part of life.
Life lessons from David Campese. I mean, brilliant. Absolutely. You're not wrong. Do you know the other thing I've completely forgotten to ask you about was, I'm going to call it English Sevens Rugby's greatest moment, which was winning at Murrayfield in 93.
The first Rugby World Cup, yeah.
Yeah, 93. Yeah. You were a part of that. That was Andy Harriman's greatest
Mark
hour.
Mark Harriman, who just left me in the dust now.
Wow.
It was quick.
I got it at 22. It is 22. And mate, he just...
gone.
He was quick.
Thank you so much. Thanks, lovely
guys.
To see you, Campo.
I'm glad you got a wording, guys.
Good on you.
Thanks, mate.
And I'm sure we'll catch up further down the track as well.
Just next year, mate. Give me a call when you get to the Gold Coast. We'll have a coffee.
Yeah. Next year.
Good
coffee.
He's
on the Goldie now.
Oh, nice.
Every January.
We'll look forward to that. We'll see you for a coffee.
No worries. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Campo, thank you very much. We will let you swap out. And we will bring in a very special guest, our final guest of our podcast here in Hong Kong. He's going to surprise one or two, I think.
How are we going, chaps?
Hello, brother. How are you? Good? How's Macau?
David James, how are you?
Macau was very brief.
Was it? Yeah, in and out.
When were you in Macau?
Do I look like I didn't have much sleep?
Yes.
No, yeah. You look all right.
But the 9 o'clock ferry is really good.
Did you go to Macau last night?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because?
Macau.
Because we saw you yesterday.
My partner was DJing last night in Macau.
A proper DJ?
Yeah.
He DJs as well, actually.
Do you?
Yeah. And he's an amazing painter.
Are you?
Yeah, very good painter. Very good painter.
A man of many, many
talents.
He's going
to paint me like one of his French ladies.
and I gave up the cello to play rugby.
That again?
Yeah.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Wow. Did you play rugby at school?
Lithwasters, right.
Yeah.
What position?
My dad used to play for Wasps. My granddad used to play for Wasps.
How amazing. I did not know that. Yeah. So you're wearing the resplendent red. You are over here in what capacity?
So Carlsberg... they're the beer sponsor for the Rugby Sevens.
Got you.
They've been a sponsor of Liverpool for 32 years now, since the beginning of the Premier League.
Right.
This is the first time I've come to the Sevens.
Yeah.
Didn't realise what carnage it can be.
Yeah. So give us a description of what you have made of the last three days.
Interestingly, and just looking back now, that it's quite empty, isn't it, at the South Stand?
Yeah.
The first day was a little bit fuller and got fuller throughout the day. But yesterday was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Did you end up going in there?
I'm going in today.
Oh, yeah. Are you really? Good luck.
I'm not allowed to say this on a podcast, but Max, the Hong Kong captain, apparently the players aren't allowed in the South Stand, but he's going in there after the game.
Is he? Right.
And I'm going with him.
We went in yesterday. It was gone.
They're going to pull you limb from limb.
Did he smell?
Don't
worry about the smell. You're going to get torn limb from limb in there. They're going to rip your sleeve. Yeah, honestly, there'll be nothing left of you.
No, I'll just go and sit next to someone who's asleep.
What do you make of this? I mean, you've played in some cauldrons. I mean, Anfield is one of the greatest stadiums on the planet.
I played here before. So 17 years ago, Portsmouth played in the Asia Trophy, which was against Fulham and Liverpool.
Was that under Harry? Who was that?
Yeah. We won.
You won it.
The place was packed with Liverpool fans, and I think it was about 300 Portsmouth fans who probably well, we won, so we were happy. So, but the Sevens event, as I say, yesterday it's just mental. And there's a bit where us being like athletes or former athletes, you're on the pitch now, running, and it's hard graft out there as well, and you're trying your best to win. Knowing that the people who are watching, you probably don't even know that you've just done what you did.
Yeah.
And we'll forget about what they saw today because they'll be hungover tomorrow.
Yeah.
So is that like, I don't know, the weird mixture?
I know what I mean. It's interesting with you, because obviously one of the things we talk about as rugby players is the kind of experience you have at football matches, the intensity, the atmosphere.
Tribalism.
The tribalism is mad. We don't really have that in rugby, but this sort of South Stand is the closest we kind of get to. Did you feel that kind of vibe
here?
Yeah.
I mean, the interesting one, I mean, I mentioned Max from Hong Kong. The first day, Hong Kong played China.
Hong Kong beat China twice.
You know, there was a lot of cheering. And I know, without going too deep into the politics about what's going to happen next time, and whether Hong Kong are involved and all that stuff. But when your home team are getting supported by your home support, it makes the whole atmosphere. Yeah. And it was superb yesterday, as I say. And yeah, South Stand, you better get busy.
Good
imagine being playing a goal, being a goal in front of the South Stand, because you obviously be a goalie anyway. You must.
I'd get battered.
You must hear everything. Yeah, you must. It must have been. How did you deal with that as a player? I've always wanted to know that as a player, going to a rival team, just hearing them shout, because in rugby, someone might go, sit down, or you're an idiot.
So my last rugby experience was Saracens versus Leicester Tigers at Wembley, where they clapped each other's team scoring. You know, the Saracens fans next to Leicester fans, drinking beer, drunk enjoying themselves, clapping the opposition. I was like, what is going on? My worst experience in football has to be Crawley Town.
Sorry, who? Crawley Town?
Yeah, 2010, 2011, after the World Cup, 2,500 fans, one geezer, for 90 minutes telling me how shit I was and how I let my country down. It was like,
really?
90 minutes.
How'd you deal with that?
I tried to ignore him, but I'm talking about it now. It really,
his eye struck, because obviously we get...
You get that every week on the podcast.
Yeah, we do, yeah.
You get yourself down, your family, your
parents.
Team.
We hate you. Yeah. Dad, stop doing that. No, when we walk past, we get, you know, people do shout, like, get into you. Do you just shrug it off? Do you just turn around and go,
you know what it's like? And weirdly, like, you'll be in a, I don't know, 60, 70,000, whatever it is, a bigger stadium. You don't even know there's a crowd there. You just play the game. The final whistle goes, it's like, wow, I've just played 90 minutes. Other times, I say 2,500, and you can hear every voice, and it's just like, mate, do me a favour. Go to the toilet or do something.
Yeah. Do you still follow the game now? I mean, do you keep a keen interest? Are you a casual fan? How much rugby do you watch? Or rugby?
Not so much, because I moved to Exeter.
Okay.
Befriended the Exeter Chiefs guys.
Yeah.
One of the best nights out ever.
Good.
Can I tell the story?
Yeah, of course.
We used to go down this pub, and we used to call it Pizza Wedge, because the tables were always wobbly. We always had pizza, and you had to stick a bit of pizza underneath the table to keep it level. Anyway, the one night they've gone, freshers' night in Exeter Town Centre. I'm thinking, what? Like, big geezers, freshers' uni night, and I'm thinking, this is going to be carnage. And we went in there, we sat on the table, just got absolutely hammered, didn't even notice anyone else, and I thought, I need to go out with these guys more. It was just like a proper night out, proper blokes having proper drink. So I followed the Chiefs, woodchop, whatever it was.
Tomahawk chop. Something like that.
Tomahawk chop.
And when you, because you obviously played a little bit, who were the guys that you would have watched growing up? Do you watch any rugby?
In rugby?
Yeah.
Loz.
Really?
Yeah, because he was funny.
Of course. Great days.
Johnny Wilkinson. Interestingly, my goalie coach at...
Dave Allred was the kicking coach for me.
Was he? Did you ever compare notes? Or, I mean, obviously Bex did that thing with Johnny.
I didn't speak to Johnny, you know, but yeah. Dave came in and it was like, I don't need a kicking coach. And then like 3 hours later, I was like, wow, this guy has just completely transformed my game.
He was that good? Superb. Really?
Yeah.
Very methodical though, isn't he? It's all about...
Yeah. And then he went into golf.
Yeah.
I met him in a gym in Portsmouth and he went... Well, golf's like football, but upside down.
Don't get C-shaped. J-shaped.
All about the J's.
I'll never forget the World Cup. Johnny couldn't hit a barn door with a bazooka. And everyone was like, where's Dave Allred? On the golf course every day. He came back with an unbelievable tan. Johnny couldn't kick anything. We got done for ball tampering. Every day, we're like, where's Dave?
Everyone lost that. It was just our fault.
Yeah.
It was your fault.
The best thing is, Dave, he's an amazing, amazing coach, but he obviously didn't learn people's names because he just couldn't care. So we call the fitness guy, oh, fitness guy, or tackle bag guy, or ball man. It's like, Dave, for fuck's sake, you know exactly who they are. So we just start calling him kicking guy. Like, kicking guy, will you come in, please? He's a loomer.
When I see him, I'm going to call him kicking guy.
Kicking guy.
What's in store for the rest of the day? Are you out and about and shaking hands and enjoying what the carnage that continues? Well,
given I've had 2 hours sleep, I'm just waiting for it to warm up a little bit because it's not warm enough at the moment.
Yeah, true.
We have a kicking challenge at half time soon.
Right.
I will probably win.
Good. Who are you up against?
A couple of Hong Kong guys.
Okay.
So we've got a kicking challenge. We're going to be here for all the games. And at some point, I will probably be drunk.
Right. Have you tried it off the team?
South.
Have you tried to kick a ball off the team before? Have you,
like.
No, no, no. You stick your foot in and make a little mound over.
You get old school.
Proper old school. Old school.
Get the sand out.
Get a sand cast. You've seen that? They used to put a bucket of sand.
Bucket of sand.
Unbelievable guy. Neil Jenkins for Wales. Mate, unbelievable kid, literally, little sandcastle manufacturer.
He's missed that whole era. He's gone back to Paul Thorburn.
Big
heel.
He's building a sandcastle.
The thing is, there's no mud in these pictures anymore.
You can't dig it in. Just get a load of deso wherever it is, or weave.
What you get as we wrap up this show is just a sense of what the Hong Kong Sevens is all about. It's a great time with great people having an enormous amount of fun. Thank you so much for diving in.
I'm so glad you've dressed up for the occasion as well.
One of us has got to make an effort. There's barely a soul left in this man, and we've got a bit of repairing to do from your performance last night.
I'm surprised one of you two or both of you aren't dressed as Hulk Hogan or Rick.
You were dressed as a rugby ball yesterday. That was a particularly low point.
You should have come as the Bushwhackers.
Yeah, I'm on brand. So, because they're paying me, I've got to look like this. Do you know what I mean? Otherwise, I would have come as some sort of a traffic cone or something like that, or a comedy donut or something.
You're our fourth guest, three of us. We've had seven people talking about the state of sevens. There is so much to look forward to as this form of the sport moves forwards. But I think from the three of us and for everyone who's been here in Hong Kong, it is one of the greatest weekends in the sport in Canada. If you haven't been, make sure you do. Thank you to everyone for looking after us over a remarkable 4 days. Stop it and behave. We are the good, the bad, and the rugby with Continental Tyres. What is left of us is going on to Australia. We'll see you very soon. Thanks so much for tuning in. Enjoy your week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Good, Yay, The Bad, and The Rugby, Oof, with Alex Payne, James Haskell, and Mike Tyndall. Thanks for listening.